It's Ideasphere with author and journalist Chris Tomlinson, Tomlinson's Hill.
When we teach our children that skin color is not the way to determine whether someone is with us or against us, we win. And the most exciting thing is that neuroscientists have discovered that that part of the brain can be retrained in a matter of days just by building friendships, working as teams, coming together to accomplish something that's bigger than us as individuals.
After spending 11 years in Africa as bureau chief for the Associated Press, Chris Tomlinson returned home to Texas. Seeing oppression and apartheid in South Africa made him want to uncover his own ancestral past, specifically his family's history as slave owners. Hello, I'm Guy Rathbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. With his book, Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black, Chris Tomlinson provides his readers with more than a personal history. He also looks at America's past, how slavery has shaped our society. By avoiding the truth, he says, we deny our own involvement. Consequently, we hinder our healing and growth. What adds to this informative read is Tomlinson's discovery of his African-American counterpart, LaDainian Tomlinson, one of the greatest running backs in the history of the National Football League. LaDainian provides the foreword for this book. The author joins me for the program. Mr. Tomlinson, thanks so much for taking this time.
Well, thank you, Guy.
Quite a seminal piece of work you've done at this side of your career, all those years with AP. Had you considered authoring a nonfiction book from the start, or was this something that just cropped up as you began to look at your ancestral shaded past?
I intended to write a book all along, mostly because I felt like it was something that needed to be said and something that needed to be examined. Having spent so many years with people telling me that their ancestors were also slaveholders, but they were the good slaveholders. So many times have I heard people say, oh, the past doesn't matter, or why can't black people just get over slavery? So I felt like we needed a book like this, and that's what I set out to do.
In your youth, you were hearing stories about slave ownership, and your family was repeating what so many do, but we were the good slave owners.
It was my grandfather who said our slaves loved us so much they took Tomlinson as their last name. And it was my father who kind of gave these sidelong glances every time my grandfather said that. But neither of them said any more. My grandfather didn't go into any more detail, and neither did my father.
When you first realized that that was a distortion of the truth, your emotions on that level?
So much of my self-esteem as a little boy was believing that my ancestors were Texas Rangers and heroes and aristocrats and part of this noble cause. And growing older, it was hard to accept that maybe those things weren't true, or maybe the story was more complicated.
What you refer to as the myth of Southern aristocracy.
Yes, look at Gone with the Wind. Look at the way our popular culture has portrayed slaveholders. And there were very few people that had big plantations like the ones in the Gone with the Wind. And my family's plantation was certainly not one of those. It was a clapboard house, and a very modest one at that. Most of the capital was tied up in the slaves and as an investment, as a way of doing business.
And you can go all the way back to the early 1800s, prior to the Civil War, to trace your family. The beginnings of that come from Churchill Jones, who, in reading his work, firmly believed in belittling and beating of slaves.
He was an entrepreneur of his time. He made his money by purchasing unimproved land cheaply and then using slave labor to turn them into profitable plantations, and either selling it to someone else and buying a bigger piece of land, or using the profits to expand his plantation holdings. So for him, applying the whip the proper management of slaves was key to his financial success. And he really did look at them as machines and chattel, much more so than as human beings.
Since that time, with your great-great-great-great aunt, if I'm rattling that off correctly.
You are.
This is the first time since then that the area of Tomlinson Hill was not occupied, at least with one member of the family of that name.
That's right. Churchill Jones's wife was Susan Tomlinson Jones, and she's the one that picked out the land for her brother and invited her brother to move to Texas from Alabama with his 48 slaves. So she was the first one on the hill. The last Tomlinson to live on the hill was a black man named Oliver Terry Tomlinson, and he died in a car accident in 2007. I would say that his descendants, including the football player LaDainian Tomlinson, a star running back with the San Diego Chargers, still visits the hill, and they still hold family reunions on Tomlinson Hill.
Let's move to that, since you brought up LaDainian, because he's a very important figure, not only writing the foreword to your book, but a central figure in understanding race relations, what he had to deal with, and who he is today, what he's become, and the background and connection with Tomlinson Hill.
Well, he is my contemporary among the black Tomlinsons, along with his brother LeVar and his sister Landria and his stepbrothers and stepsisters. And he really kind of symbolizes the African-American youth of this generation, because his father wanted to protect him from the painful parts of the history. LaDainian grew up believing that the hill was named after his family, and in some ways it was, but it was originally named for the slaveholders. And he symbolized what's possible by becoming a star football player and making millions of dollars and retiring, and now he's a philanthropist in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But he didn't know his history, and his lack of history bothered him, and he also wanted to learn what was the true story of his ancestors, because it was one that his father had not shared with him, and he was born after his grandfather died.
Interesting, too, how your background, not knowing the ancestry, included quite a period of time reporting from South Africa, where you saw firsthand what was happening in a bitterly racist society.
I was privileged to get to report on the end of apartheid in South Africa in 1993 and 1994. And then in later years, I would visit the country and report on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission intended to help that country get over its painful past. And one of the key lessons I think that Archbishop Desmond Tutu taught us was that in order to have justice, in order to begin the path toward reconciliation, we first have to agree on what happened. We have to have a common understanding of our history. And that means in South Africa that perpetrators of atrocities got up and testified with immunity about what they did and why they did it. The victims were there and were allowed to confront them and tell their own stories. This is something that we haven't had in this country about the era of post-Reconstruction and Jim Crow and pre-civil rights, where children are still brought up to believe that there is such a thing as good slaveholders, or that there's no one around today who benefited from the oppression and the denial of rights and opportunities of black people.
So the foundation was established with the idea that if we were to confront these issues, as you're talking about, we could start seeing humanity in all creeds and colors. This concept is working well in South Africa, but America hasn't even come close.
I don't think so. I think we talk about race all the time, but I don't think we talk about history. And there's a key difference there. When we talk about affirmative action, or we talk about reparations, or we talk about what we can do today to make things more equal in terms of jobs and economic opportunity and education, there are a lot of people who want to deny the impact of the past. They don't want to acknowledge that there was systematic oppression and that their ancestors were given a head start and given advantages because of a racist system. those things echo today in our society. And it's something that in order for us to address it, we have to be honest about it.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with Chris Tomlinson, the book is Tomlinson Hill. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd recommend for folks to conduct more research?
Well, we have tomlinsonhill.com, where you can learn more about the book. You can also learn about our film, which is also called Tomlinson Hill, and it's about current day Falls County and how the descendants of slaves and slaveholders are still struggling to overcome the bigotry of the past, to join together to face that community's problems with rural poverty. We also have an interactive website where we've uploaded some of the 200 oral histories that we've collected along the way so that people can watch the full interviews, and many of them lasting for 4 or 5 hours, and to hear from people's own mouths what their stories were. We'd like to see this project reach beyond just the book. We're now offering the documentary on-demand video on Vimeo.
Okay. We'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange for those who would like to share that link. You may do so, prx.org under Ideasphere. Talking again with Chris Tomlinson, Tomlinson Hill. I want to move to your own personal realization that you wrap up your book with, actually, but I think it's important we bring it in now. Your realization that you gained what you did through your life by the color of your skin.
The privilege of having white skin was never more obvious to me than living in Africa. I could go to war zones and people wouldn't hurt me because they knew that hurting a white person meant that someone would come looking or it would cause trouble. I'd walk into government offices and ministers who would treat black constituents horribly would always jump up and give me their seat and be ready to talk to me. In South Africa, I remember going to a white supremacist rally and being asked if I was a member of the Ku Klux Klan delegation because they had a VIP seating area for me if I was a member of the Klan. When I came back to America, I experienced the same things. When I go into a restaurant, I'm treated differently than an African-American or a Hispanic or even an Asian. And I think it's that international travel that opened my eyes to that. And it's something that I think most Americans haven't experienced.
How do you feel people are accepting of your work now? And this is something that is going to be a little challenging to answer because, as you mentioned just a moment ago, we do talk about it in America, but we really don't address it as has occurred now in South Africa. So you have written a book that's going to rub some folks the wrong way because they feel like we have advanced. Let's not keep looking behind us.
The election of a black president provides an excuse for many people to say the past doesn't matter or we're in a post-racial America. But when you look at the statistics, when you look at mortality and you look at education and you look at income and business ownership, countless measures of well-being, you see that African Americans are not performing as well as whites in those statistics. And one of the things I try to do in this book is show you how that happened and why that happened.
Yes.
Through the eyes of these two families, the experiences of these two families. There's one portion of the book where I talk about my father attending elementary school in Dallas, where it was a beautiful brick building with air conditioning and violin lessons and German lessons, and really just kind of a very fine education with qualified teachers and small class size. Then I take a look at his contemporary on the Black Tomlinson side, a man named Charles, who went to a sharecropper school in a one-room shack with 35 kids in grades 1 through 8, two teachers teaching in shifts, and an outhouse. No gym, no music, and tattered textbooks. That's one generation ago. And then you ask, why is the educational achievement not the same across the races? It's because of our history. When people say history is behind us and it doesn't matter, it lives in each and every one of us on how we live our lives today.
Well, this is exactly what you're talking about with LaDainian and his experience when he was growing up. Your contemporary received just the opposite of what you did.
Yes, LaDainian is a decade younger than I am, and so his experience was very different from mine. I was going to school during desegregation, and LaDainian was going to school post-desegregation. He went to integrated schools in Waco, Texas, and as a sports star, he was much more readily accepted by the larger culture, and he didn't see it as much in his early childhood. It wasn't until he started playing high school football and traveling around the state that he would be in some small town and score a touchdown, and people would start yelling the N-word at him. And that's when he began to realize these are the 1990s, but there are still people out there who want to oppress him and keep him down and discourage him.
And this is something we have instilled in our society, whether we want to admit it or not.
We have probably the least racist generation in American history alive today, and they're college-age kids and kids who are in school. By any measure, by every test, they feel that race doesn't matter. But still, 60% of them report having heard racist language or seen racist graffiti or felt some sort of racism toward them. So we have hope for the future, but even these kids who are supposedly growing up in a post-racial America are experiencing the same things that LaDainian and me and my father and my grandfather did.
The book we're talking about is Tomlinson's Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. Written by journalist and author Chris Tomlinson. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Chris Tomlinson, Tomlinson's Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. This may be a rather tough question, but there is an answer here for understanding America's racism. We are one of very few nations left that has this built into our society.
We have a major problem with race in America, and it's something that we have to deal with. And I know there are a lot of people with a lot of ideas on what to do. I think part of the reason why this continues to be a problem is that we have a dominant population that doesn't want to talk about the past, who wants to continue to hold up their ancestors with a sense of pride. In Texas, we have a group, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who want to put the Confederate battle flag on our license plates of our cars. And that boggles my mind, because by doing so, by celebrating their racist ancestors, they're denying 14% of the population their history and their suffering during that history. And as long as that kind of thing persists, I think we're going to consistently see racism as a problem in our society.
It seems to me that addressing it through that level, saying that this is a symbol of our society, that is the Confederate flag, is denying that it is also the symbol of what is wrong with our society.
There are a lot of people who find, like me as a child, a great deal of self-esteem in the accomplishments of their ancestors. And genealogy and tracing your family is an exciting hobby. It's like unraveling a mystery, and we'll tell you some things that are exciting. I found that it's so much more satisfying and engrossing to know the full story, to know the whole history, to understand that my family were pioneers in the settlement of Texas, and they contributed to the Texas economy, and they fought for what they believed in the Civil War, while also acknowledging that they were on the wrong side of history, that they chose to defend a system that was indefensible, a system that they knew was wrong. My ancestors, in their letters, took great pains never to use the word slave. They used the word Negroes instead, because it was an uncomfortable word for them. They read in the newspaper every day about abolitionists who were making biblical and constitutional arguments against slavery. So to me, that's a valuable lesson of how each one of us has to maintain a moral code that we're going to stick to. And just because our relatives or our society tells us to go one way, we have to stick to our guns. And there were people who did that in Falls County. My great-grandfather's father-in-law fled Texas at the beginning of the Civil War because he opposed slavery, and he became a Union soldier and fought against the South, and then came home to Texas and helped to establish what he had hoped would be a more race-neutral society in the South. That failed, but that's an example of someone who bucked the trend. And so I can be proud of both, you know, and I find it, and I challenge people who really only want to believe in that one thing and ignore the rest, that they're denying themselves an opportunity.
There's a key here, too, and you mentioned that your ancestor came back to Texas in an effort to reconcile, and it failed. Part of that failure was so wrapped up in America's efforts to try to appease the South and bring them back into the fold of the United States. And in so doing, the Supreme Court undermined everything that had been established at the end of the Civil War.
The North really wanted to get the economy buzzing again, and they wanted to get the politics solved. And while they made a good, solid 7-year effort at Reconstruction and used the Freedmen's Bureau to try to instill civil rights across the South, they didn't have enough money. The Civil War had bankrupted both sides. They needed to demilitarize and demobilize the Civil War soldiers. So, yes, when faced with the enormity of the task of trying to turn the South into a multiracial civil rights society, they gave up and went with political expediency. And that led to Jim Crow laws and segregation and the systematic denial of political and economic rights to Black people. And frankly, my great-grandfather was a part of that as a politician and as a county-level official in Falls County to try to make sure that they imposed slavery by another name.
Have you gone beyond this book now with your work? Is it taking on a life of its own and unexpectedly?
You know, after working on a book like this for 7 years, you know, you get lost in it. You get buried in it, and you come to the assumption that everybody knows what you know, and that is my book really going to say anything that new? You know, because I'm building on the work of so many wonderful authors and historians to pull this together. But I'm surprised at the reception that it's getting and the interest in it. I'm encouraged by it. I'm a business columnist for the Houston Chronicle. I try to be a moral voice for the business community in Texas. And I guess the lessons I learned about the need for voices to demand good behavior is one that I take with me into my daily work today.
Where do you go from here? You've written this book, you've set up a website bringing people together.
I think I'm going to continue to shout from every megaphone that I can get a hold of for people to know their history, to read this book and to read others like it, to understand how we got to where we are today. It's a good news story. I mean, this book ends with LaDainian and I working together on it. It ends LeVar Tomlinson, a Black man, and I going to the Lincoln Memorial together and standing at the spot where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech about the sons of slaves and the sons of slaveholders coming together in brotherhood. So, you know, I think for those who really don't want to dredge up the past, I would tell them that you'll be much more excited about today and the future if you know how far we've come. The lessons for us are on how to move forward are in the past. All we have to do is open our eyes to them.
And as you wrap up your work with the more familiar, and I'm summarizing this in a paraphrasing, the more familiar we are with something, anything, the more comfortable we are with it.
That's right. That's right. You know, there are neuroscientists who are doing tests about the biology of bigotry. And, you know, they've traced it to the fight or flight mechanism in our brains that kept us alive when we were being hunted, saber-toothed tigers, or when we were living in tribes and on the African plains trying to eke out an existence. And what we know is, yes, you know, fearing people who are not like us is part of our survival instinct. But we have to be taught who are the people that are not like us. And when we teach our children that skin color is not the way to determine whether someone is with us or against us, we win. And the most exciting thing is that neuroscientists have discovered that part of the brain can be retrained in a matter of days just by, you know, building friendships, working as teams, coming together to accomplish something that's bigger than us as individuals. And those old beliefs fade away.
Well, Mr. Tomlinson, thank you so much for your time. I sincerely appreciate this effort and what you're accomplishing.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk about it.
We will, I hope, talk again sometime soon.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you. My guest has been Chris Tomlinson, business columnist for the Houston Chronicle. For more than 20 years, he's reported from around the world and has served as the East Africa Bureau Chief for the United Press. His stories covered the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Check out his website at tomlinsonhill.com. His book, Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.